This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here for today's interview episode with Rebecca Ford.
Hi, Katie.
Rebecca, you and I did the interviews for this week's episode. And first, we'll hear my conversation with Sam Mendes and Olivia Colman, the director and writer, and then also the star of Empire of Light, a movie we talked about last week as maybe getting targeted by critics for a sentimentality. But I think that we both agree it's just this like pretty emotional experience. It's very closely based on Sam Mendes' mother, which he talked about in this interview. And it's got yet another in a string of Olivia Colman performances where you just cannot take your eyes off of her. And her character is so multifaceted, kind of going through these periods of, you know, extreme quiet and then mania as someone who's struggling with mental illness. I keep thinking about this movie a lot. Rebecca, I believe you're a fan of it as well.
Yeah, I think it might be my favorite Olivia Colman performance of the recent collection.
Yeah.
I just felt, you know, she really captures the sort of highs and lows of that character's struggles with mental illness. And for me, when I saw it, I felt like this is coming from somewhere personal. So I'm curious, Katie, if Sam was able to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting asking him, like, what is it like to put yourself out there on the set like that and have people be like, so what was your mom like in these really vulnerable moments? And he said everyone was really respectful of it, but that Olivia really, you know, leaned on him and was able to ask him about those things. And the dynamic between the two of them, they were sitting in the room together when I talked to them, having just been stuck in New York traffic, and they really make each other laugh. Like, they didn't know each other before making this movie, but it feels like such a natural connection. And Olivia said at one point, like, I've decided I only want to make one movie a year, and I want Sam Mendes to direct it. So who
great.
Knows?
It might be
the first of many. So let's hear that conversation with Sam Mendes and Olivia Colman. Well, I'm here joined by Sam Mendes and Olivia Colman, joining today to speak about Empire of Light, which is just open in U.S. theaters. Hello to you both. Thank you for braving New York City traffic to talk to me.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Hi. Thanks, Katie.
So, Sam, you talked about this story and kind of approaching it during pandemic lockdown. And it's interesting to me that this was right after this huge success of 1917. You'd been busy. You'd been traveling all over the place talking this movie. And then the whole world shuts down. And I wonder if that contrast was what made you especially start thinking about loneliness and quietude when the pandemic started and this story entered your mind.
Yeah, I think I had about a year after 1917 where I was, none of us knew what was happening. I mean, we didn't know it was going to end. And it felt like we were never going to be in a cinema again, and we were never going to be in restaurants again. And, you know, so of course we all felt their absence, I guess. And so it was a strange and lonely time and a time of reflection, which I think everybody had. And it led me to reflect on things that I suppose I hadn't thought about properly for years. And in a way, you mentioned 1917, which was, you know, really based on my grandfather's experiences. It was just another stage closer to the personal for me. I think it all came out of that stillness.
Was your mother's story in mind in that way from the very beginning? Or were you thinking kind of more broadly about that period in history and movie theaters and then kind of realized that your mother was integral to the story you wanted to tell?
No, it came from wanting to tell the story. I mean, I'm an only child and I grew up alone with my mother, who was a single parent and brought me up while struggling with a mental illness. And so that was always the center of the story for me, was trying to find a way to tell that story. And Hillary, the character Olivia plays, is based loosely on my mum. And so for that's the sort of internal struggle of the film, her struggle with mental illness. The other part of the film was an external struggle, really, which was the political struggles that I lived through for my own political opinions, really, when I was in the early 80s, when I was a teenager. And the sort of racial tensions of those years and the Thatcher years, high unemployment and all of that stuff. And both of those things were stories I wanted to tell. And I just had to try and find a way to pull them together. And the cinema was the way that I ended up doing it, that they both these characters work in the cinema. So it happened in sort of that order, really.
Yeah. Olivia, did that early pandemic loneliness kind of hit you too? Was that resonant for you when the script came to you and Sam presented this story?
No, I have a very unpopular, I loved being in lockdown. I say that, you know, carefully, because I know that so many people had the most awful time, but I found it was a gift to, we're lucky, I don't live with any, you know, baddies. So we just enjoyed having time together, time with my kids that I wouldn't have got. So
yeah,
I'm afraid I loved it. I could have done it for another 2 years. Quite happy.
Be careful what you wish for. You never know what's coming next.
Yeah.
So Sam has said that he wrote this part with you in mind. Did he tell you that when he sent you this?
I think you said that on the first Zoom. Yeah. We'd never met before. And I suddenly got a message that Sam Mendes wants to do a Zoom with you. I went, okay. in my kitchen. And we met and he said, I'm writing something, with you in mind. I'm like, okay, great. And then we just chatted. We just talked about nonsense and our ailments. My sore knees, his sore ankles. And we just it was very easy, very comfortable. It was a lovely chat. And so I didn't know what I'd said yes to. And then after the Zoom, you think, oh, God, I hope it's not a terrible script. Luckily, when it came through, I was happily surprised.
I was sort of stuck at the time writing it because I didn't know. I got halfway and I sort of gave up. And, you know, like most people who try to write, my laptop is filled with folders that say things like unfinished football project and unfinished, you know, whatever project. And this was another unfinished project. And I was persuaded by my wife. So if you're writing it for a living, you should call her. Maybe she'll just talking to her. Cause I didn't know her. I'd never spoken to her before. We'll just shake it up a bit and maybe get you going. And it did. So it was really just seeing her open face and her hearing her enthusiasm for the general idea. I didn't really want to tell her the story because I wanted it to be fresh when she read it. And that did get me going again. And I restarted writing it again. And then, you know, got to the end. Miracle of miracles. I managed to finish it.
Olivia, when you have a director or someone who you don't know who reaches out and says they want to work with you, do you seek out other actors who've worked with Sam? Do you try to find a vibe or something about someone that says, oh, yeah, you're someone I want to work with?
Yeah, I should have done that.
You should have done your search.
Really.
You've only yourself to blame.
I didn't. No, I really should have done that. Because I'd seen so much of Sam's work and I liked the chat on the Zoom so much, it seemed so sort of friendly and warm, that I didn't think to ask. No.
Fair enough. Sam, aside from the history of that time in your family, were there any like references either to movies or books or any like anything that you look toward as an inspiration for this as a visual reference or anything that you drew from as putting together what this would look or feel like?
Not really. I was very inspired by the place when we found Margate and by the cinema. A lot of it was memories of a cinema that I'd been to a lot as a child on the South Coast, which is now long since closed down. So there was a lot of that. When I started working with Roger Deakins, there was a lot of photography that we were inspired by. There's a photographer called Harry Greer. And
photography from this period in time or of movie theaters, or what about it?
Well, it's full of influences. I mean, you know, every movie that's on in the cinema was a movie that meant something to me. Every song that's played, every poster on the wall, you know, so it was a time, you know, I think for most people when they're in their late teens, when music and movies mean so much more than than other times in their life. You know, it, it's when you first really feel you discover popular culture. And I just wanted the movie, I wanted the cinema to feel real and not feel like some cute art house cinema, but to feel like a giant, the cinemas I remember, big independent cinemas that were playing commercial films and, you know, movies like Being There and The Elephant Man and Raging Bull and all that jazz as well, you know. A great era in movies, much underrated, I think.
Yeah. So then approaching Hillary, you've got the script, you've got Sam's obviously really close connection to the character. What do you draw from to bring her to life?
It was very clear in the script, the journey that Hillary has. And I did have Sam there every step of the way, obviously, as a director. It wasn't allowed to step off set. but just holding my hands all the way, and I had him to ask. So the best research material ever is to ask Sam, who spent his entire life watching very closely a woman who, you know, had this continuing sort of trajectory of gloriousness and going down. So when I could say, what, you know, when someone comes off lithium, what's the, how do they feel? I had Sam to tell me.
Yeah.
And I think mainly just empathy. You know, if you read a script and you can feel how, I think it was quite clear how she might feel. I think actors have to have empathy.
Sam, what was it like bringing yourself on set in that way? Obviously, you put part of yourself in every movie that you make, but being asked questions about your mother while you're at work feels intense in maybe a way that you hadn't done before.
Yeah, I found people were really respectful of it, though. They waited for me to say it. They didn't sort of go, so what did your mum do then? you know, because I think they were aware that it was a very, there was something very private about it. Also, it wasn't directly, you know, I stressed that the movie, you know, I wanted to make something that was going to be exciting on a number of levels. And I didn't want it to just be about, you know, directly autobiographical, you know. And so Hillary doesn't have a child. It's not directly autobiographical. It's not actually exactly what my mother lived through, but her condition, Hillary's condition and the way she handles it is exactly the same. So there were moments when it was really weird and like a sort of flashback and quite cathartic, you know, when you're recreating, you know, your flat from when you were a kid and you know, what your, you know, the images that you remember from sort of multiple breakdowns and also the sort of psychological carnage that took place in those years. And then there were other times when it felt entirely new and invented, which a lot of it was. And I suppose I found the bits I invented much more joyful than the ones that were more like sort of, you know, drama therapy. But of course, the center of the film, you know, which is in many ways, you know, Hillary's crash, was from my, you know, direct recollection. And so those days were strange and haunting and kind of amazing too, because what Olivia does, I think, is amazing. It's miraculous with that part, you know, and she moved me, you know, more than I can say, both while we were doing it and afterwards. And so, yeah, it was an interesting seesaw between the two, I guess.
Did it make you want to make more films more closely into your life, or make you say, never again, I'm moving on?
It made me want to not make the next one directly from my own personal experience. I think possibly you might find the next one's a long way away from it. But because I think it's quite lonely, actually. It's quite a lonely experience writing it all on your own and then directing it. And, you know, it being during lockdown also, or the tail end of lockdown, really kind of accentuated that. We were very isolated, you know, and it's in itself a very isolating place, Margate in the winter. It's cold and there's nobody around. And so it felt like we were in a bubble, and it was quite a lonely experience for me. The next one, I would want to be surrounded by people doing something that is not in any way a part of my past life.
And this is maybe a question for both of you. What is it about British beach towns that make filmmakers want to go and just have everyone be very contemplative and sad? Like the happy British beaches don't seem to exist very much in film. And maybe this is a very American question. I don't know what Margate feels like, but it feels of a piece with a lot of other films.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong. I mean, you know, Margate had, you know, J.M.W. Turner came and painted many of his great canvases there. As you said, it was the the most beautiful skies in Europe. It's the northern sky, the north coast of Kent. So it looks up towards the North Sea. And T.S. Eliot wrote The Wasteland, sitting staring out at the beach in the winter. And he himself writes in The Wasteland on Margate Sands, "I can connect nothing with nothing," he says. Hmm. So it's clearly somewhere where people have gone. There's a sort of there's a bleak beauty and a melancholy to it, which really does communicate when you're there. And when it's full of people in the summer, it just feels like another friendly seaside town. It lacks the sort of mythic scale that you get when it's the winter and there's these, you know, it feels very empty and desolate, but also beautiful, which it did when we shot there. And you know, we felt rather possessive about it after a while. And then people arrived. It's like, what are these people doing? Go away. You know, so yeah, I think it's just an atmosphere, maybe.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So, Olivia, when Sam talks about the joyful moments of the movie, I think of the scenes between you and Michael Ward, and especially these really beautiful bonding scenes. There's such a variety of things that you do together. And when you're working with any actor, you're creating a bond like that. But the attention of falling in love with someone on screen, I think, is really specific. So can you just, you know, talk about what you guys did to create that?
Well, Michael is, I defy anyone not to slightly fall in love with Michael, because he's just so joyful, and he loves coming to work, and he loves learning from everyone around him, and he's a really an electric energy. And I was much more nervous than him, and he was much more mature than me about the intimate scenes, which I found incredibly embarrassing initially, until then we had Ita O'Brien, an intimacy coordinator, who came and helped me. Michael just went, "It's okay, we can do this." And then it became, she turned it everything into a sort of dance routine for me particularly, I think, and made it so easy. And it was lovely. And it was lovely to be doing this journey with Michael. We trusted each other. And it was fine. Very easy, actually.
The intimacy coordinator thing is interesting because that's happened more and more in film sets in recent years. And, you know, you've had intimate scenes before. So is the difference having a choreographer in that way? Is that what makes it feel?
Yeah, it's so much better. It's, well, I can imagine there are bad ones which don't help at all. If anything, they probably get in the way. But Ita was brilliant. And I think you.
Yeah. No, I tell you, I was very nervous. I mean, I've always done it myself as part of my job of directing, whether it be on stage or on screen. You know, any intimate scenes of, you know, I've ended up being able to control myself, and I was nervous, and she was fantastic. She made my life so much easier. It's partly a mix of practical clues, but it's also just having the actors can talk to someone without fear of judgment. That's not the director. So I don't feel this doesn't feel comfortable to me, whatever. And she always has a solution, but she never, ever stepped outside of it. She wanted to know what I wanted, what the shot was, and always worked within those parameters. So actually it made it incredibly easy. But she was an actress herself, Ita, and I think has that energy and understands how actors work, which I think is very good. And so her energy on set was just another, it was nice having another close collaborator who was trying to make the movie with us. It was great. Yeah.
And she was there, you know, in the sitting in the bath scenes or having a shower scenes. And she said, "What do you not want to show?" And I said, "I don't really want to show anything." And so she said, "Wear right." And she said, "You'll wear this. You can wear tracksuit bums. You can wear a." And she was there all the time just to go. I just knew that
Someone was watching.
Someone was watching out, and she'd say, "You know, do you need to be there? No, go away." And she's not that anyone's really interested, but people just they're just looking at the lights. They're doing their job, and they don't. But she was there to say, "If you don't need to hold the light, don't be there." And they went, "Oh yeah, yeah, of course." And it was just everyone was really thoughtful and lovely, but she was everyone's sort of
enforcer,
weaver. Sorry, you can tell I'm not a writer.
So, you know, Sam talked about the kind of breakdown scenes as being the ones that hit really close to home. And I think of those as being kind of intimacy in a different way, like requiring a lot of you, Olivia, as an actor. So, you know, you don't have an intimacy coordinator in those scenes, but what do you do to protect yourself or prepare for those?
Those ones I'm fine with. I don't mind those at all. I've got my clothes on. I can do anything. I didn't want to let Sam down, and I found pressure and the nervousness of that really helpful. And I don't find it embarrassing to let rip. Although we did the big breakdown scene twice, and I'm so pleased we got to do it a second time, because I think I was better at getting to the right place the second time.
And then how does Michael prepare for that? I mean, I know he should speak for himself, but when you're having that scene with a scene partner and Michael, who's kind of there, but as a witness to it, does that dynamic between you change for that?
No, we had each other's eyes to look at, and he was there with me. And, you know, in the moments when you have to reset and you want to keep in that place, and he really had my back and kept everything quiet. And that's what you should have in a fellow actor. You should really have each other's back. And he does that.
So this is a movie about movies in some ways. It's about a movie theater, obviously, but Hillary doesn't see movies as part of it. And Sam, I think it's interesting because there's so many movies that have been like, this is a love letter to what movies can do. And I don't think that's what this movie is. But you've got this really transformative moment for her to being there, which I'm also curious about. So, I mean, as someone who loves movies and understands the power of it, what balance do you keep in that to have it be such a present part of the story, but not being part of Hillary's story, and make those work together?
Yeah, I mean, I think you put it very well, Katie. I don't think it is about the magic of the movie. I think that was an unfortunate label that gets sort of stuck on anything that has a movie theater in it. You know what I mean? Now, that's not to say it's not a significant part of the movie, because it is. Because for me, you know, movies, and for the characters, movies are an escape. But of course, for our central character, she is terrified of being overwhelmed. So she never goes to the movies. She's a cautious, fearful of the kind of immersion of going into a dark room and watching a movie. So for her, the climax of the story, I don't want to give anything away, is that moment where she finally plucks up the courage, and the reasons why she plucks up the courage. And then for me, the decision was, well, when finally she makes that big leap into the dark, literally, what does she go and look at? What does she go and see that would talk to her? That was also playing in the cinemas in 1981.
Yeah,
that particular moment, and you know, and it's something, frankly, that I believe in as a filmmaker. I don't want to put a film up there that I thought was not very good. We were lucky, because for me, being there, which is a movie, a masterpiece, but in my opinion, but is also a movie about how it's possible to be broken or not a full person and still. And still have a significance in the world, still change, still mean something. That is something that I could see speaking directly to Hillary in that moment in her story. So it felt like the right one for us, for the character, and also I believe that Norman, the projectionist played by Toby Jones, would have loved the movie too, because he also would see a parallel in that film. Someone who's locked himself away for 30 years in a dark room, he would see parallels with a character who's been locked away for 30 years. So it just felt all round like it had a kind of significance. But then at the same time, you're also aware that it's sort of hubristic, isn't it? You're like, I'm going to put one of the great movies ever made at the end of my movie.
Yeah, this happens.
You know, and just sort of confront people with the fact that, you know, You know, you're always risking people going, well, you know, I'd rather see being there. So, but anyway, that, I just thought, well, it's worth a risk worth taking because it's a movie I love. I thought it made sense within the story, which is the most important thing.
Olivia, did you watch Being There while making this movie?
Yes, I did. I eventually, yes. I watched it the day before that scene.
Yeah. Mm. She'd never seen it before.
No.
And then she had to watch it. But then when we shot it, because we wanted the light playing on her face and we needed a more powerful light source, she was sort of watching a sort of weird, what was sort of collage of images because we needed the right amount of light on her face.
Oh, and interesting. What were the images?
She'd just seen. So she needed to have seen it just recently.
Yeah.
It wasn't actually in the moment of the camera pushing in on her watching the film.
Yeah, I was watching a weird mishmash of images.
So it was images from being there or just like?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So not quite so strange.
Can you imagine?
But you felt like you needed to see, you needed to have that like with you, because you know playing against a blank screen like that. I mean, I guess people do it in you know big budget movies all the time, but that's such an emotional moment, and you are looking at light. Yeah. But
Sam is so better than anyone I've ever met. Brilliant at telling you. I always thought a director has to be able to speak, you know, 11 different languages to speak to each actor in the way that they need to get in the right place, and Sam just had a shorthand and could tell me exactly what I needed at the right time. So even though he could have totally just said, described what he wanted me to feel and I'd have got it, it was really helpful to watch the film because then I could, you know, I felt like I didn't have to rely on him quite so much for that. Which was,
yeah.
And it was a great film. I'm really pleased I watched it.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, I love it when haven't seen something and you felt bad about it and then you finally see it. You're like, oh, what a gift I gave myself that I got to see this for the first time. This is a bigger question, but I thought of it because what you said about Sam's direction. Is there anything about each other's jobs on this set or in general that you envy, that you kind of wish that you got to be the other person?
No, but I think you should be an actor.
Olivia loved it when I sort of did a bit of her character. If I just a flicker of an impersonation, she would roar with laughter. She thought this was hilarious. the better for you.
I loved it.
Couldn't get enough of it.
But you became a woman.
That's what she said. That's a very, I would say that's a little bit on the generous side.
really enjoyed it. But no, I wouldn't like the responsibility. I know from watching great directors that I wouldn't be able to do what they do. I wouldn't be able to do what Sam does. And I wouldn't like to not have any scenes off.
Mm-hmm.
At least, you know, if I'm not in the scene, I get to go and have a little sit down, cup of tea, chat. Sam doesn't ever get to do that.
And then
it goes on after we finish filming. You've got to do all of the edit.
Yeah. And then all of this.
And then all of this. Yeah.
You know what I mean? You've had a break done another movie. And, you know, I just keep going. What? Droning on. You know, for me, this is the sort of, this part here is the way you say goodbye to the movie. You talk about it and talk about it until you never, ever want to see it again. And then you've said, you can say goodbye to it. But, I envy the feeling of not having the full responsibility. I mean, I love the idea of being part of that team, particularly when a cast is as warm and as brilliant as this one. I would love to have been part of the group that, you know, that told the story and then be able to step back from it. Because, you know, as you get older, you commit so much to a movie, particularly when you've written it as well as directing it, you know, it does at a certain point become exhausting. And you think, is there any way of doing this, but a little less intensely? And being part of the cast would be one way of doing that.
Yeah. I mean, Olivia, you get to walk away from this in a different way than Sam. Is there anything you've taken with you from this movie onto either other work you've done or just, you know, what ways has it lingered with you?
Like a nice coat, for example, or anything like that.
Did you take one of Hillary's coats? She has great coats. I'm so jealous.
No nice costume.
No. Ah, Hillary's table.
You took Hillary's table away. There you are. You've got an honest answer. Okay, that's really kitchen table.
No, I took away the fact.
No, is there anything you take away from this, Miss Collett? Yes, kitchen table. I'm glad I've left you with a legacy.
I was also going to say I've taken away. I want to do one film a year now from now on. And I want Sam to be the director of it.
Oh, well, deal. All right.
Okay.
Yeah. Easy challenge.
It's a deal with
Mendes. Yeah.
There we go.
This is a vulnerable movie, I think, and maybe especially for you, Sam, since it's your family.
What movie?
Having, a vulnerable movie. Like, I feel like it's emotional. It's, you know, it draws into really big feelings. And I'm curious about having it out there, if it feels raw in some way, or you feel like it, you want people to be kinder to it. Because I feel that way about this movie, being a fan of it and feeling so moved by it. And I wonder how that feels for you guys.
You always feel incredibly vulnerable every movie you make as a director. I don't feel any more. I felt more vulnerable making it. Mm. Now you know, it is what it is. People will have their opinions. And I think one of the better things about getting older is that you make more and more films, and you've been through versions of this before, and you were aware that movies find their place eventually. People find a way of seeing them. They find their own life, you know, the sort of noise that surrounds them in the immediate sort of aftermath of release is not always what survives of them. You know, I think you have to be sort of armed against the sort of the immediate critiques and the kind of white noise and just let it be, really. I also think, you know, that coming from the theatre where, you know, you really can change things all the time, you know, if you get certain critiques in the theatre, there's a part of you that thinks, oh God, that's a good, maybe I'll go and change it. You know, you can't with the movie. It's just there and that's it. So nothing you can do about it except try and persuade people to come and see it and make up their own minds. And that's what we're doing here. And that's, you know, particularly now, every time you market a film and sell a film, you get the feeling that you're not only selling your own film, but the whole idea of movies in a cinema, you know, to everyone all the time, you know.
Yeah.
It's behind every question is, you know, how do you feel about streaming? And how do you feel about this? And how do you feel? And can these things survive? And it's like, you know, that's pretty new. You know, when I started out, you know, it was a given that the movies were going to be on big screens. So, you know, we're here to try and keep it alive and let people make up their own minds.
Olivia, are movie theaters going to survive? Just going to give you the question right there.
Yeah. Okay. If I say yes, will that mean they will survive?
I don't know. Maybe.
I hope so, because it's an event I want. My kids have had, not as often as I did, and that, you know, is the same going back in generations. And I really hope they get to enjoy that spectacle, you know, for generations to come, because it is special. It's just, it's comfortable being able to watch a film in your own, you know, sort of filth on your sofa. But there's something really special about sharing it with you, other humans, and in the dark and eating popcorn.
In their filth.
In their filth. Yeah. That's never
going to happen. I'm joking.
I really hope it keeps going, because I love the cinema.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this movie, even though it's not a love letter to movies, I think it certainly gives you that energy to get back to even your possibly run down local movie theater, which I have one. It's not as beautiful as The Empire, but maybe you want to go back.
Can I do a shout out to the Peckham Plex?
Of course.
It's a cinema in Peckham, and it's amazing, and it shows all films, not just the biggies, and it's £5 a ticket to whoever, whenever. It's fucking brilliant.
Good shout out.
Sam, any movie theater you want to shout out?
My two low, The Everyman in Hampstead, and it just, you know, has sofas. You can sit there with your loved ones and snuggle up,
you can get food.
The food's great. They order in from local restaurants and cafes. You know, you get a little, you know, someone comes and makes a speech before each screening. You know, it feels like there's a human element to it. It makes you feel like, oh yeah, this is how cinema can be. You know, this is how it should be. To give it that feeling of you know, the local and some sort of human contact now that film projection is dead. The Everyman in Hampstead, great cinema.
So now, Rebecca, let's hear your conversation with Todd Field, the writer and director of Tar, who was, you know, until this year, kind of this mysterious presence in Hollywood. He hadn't made a movie in over 15 years, and then comes back with what most people are calling a masterpiece. But I understand he's, you know, not like scary, reclusive filmmaker to talk to, and is actually pretty engaging.
Yeah, he was really open. You know, this film takes so many bold risks from the opening moments when he starts rolling the credits and asking you to sit there for it. So I really wanted to know how much freedom he was given. And we talked a little bit how his initial script literally had a note in the beginning that was like, this movie is going to be long and I'm going to need to, you know, have the ability to do what I want with it. And Focus gave that to him. And it was great to hear about how he himself sort of didn't believe that this would ever happen for him.
Yeah, I can imagine that you you pitch this movie and you can see someone being like, well, I like this movie, but I don't know if Hollywood would ever make it. And Hollywood has since, you know, his last film, Little Children, only gotten more and more difficult to have these kinds of bold swings come out. But you're right. Focus Features really has gotten behind him on it. Did he reveal any of the many mysteries we all keep talking about around Tara, about what's real and what's not? And is she a real person? Maybe another mystery to discuss.
You know, I tried, Katie. he loves the fan theories. He feels like this is literally the reason you make a film. And I tried to get him to tell me how Lydia Tarr won her EGOT. And he says he does have an answer, but you'll have to listen in to see what he tells me.
I love that he loves the fan theories, though, because I feel like filmmakers can easily be like, that is not what I meant at all. You're wrong. Right. But Tarr inspires so much fun speculation. Let's hear his answer. Let's listen to your conversation with Todd Field.
I want to just like jump right in and start with Lydia Tarr, because everyone is talking about her almost like she's a real person when you look on social media. And I'm curious for you, where did this character first take shape for you? Like, what was sort of the beginning of the idea to build into Lydia?
Well, I started, she kind of appeared about 10 years ago to me. And, you know, I understand in a fashion why people do think that she's real, because she's very real to me, and has been for a long time. I wasn't sure that I would ever be able to sort of share her with anyone, because everything that I've been adapting for the last however many years has been based on underlying material where the characters have been imagined by others. But here she is, you know.
And because she has so many layers to her and her personality, did it start with sort of a, you know, this is a woman in this world of music, or did it start more with sort of who she was as a person? And
as a person, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think, as any of us know, if you have people in your household and you even passively observe people that you're related to or partnered with or friends, or we see many different sides of them, and their work life is only one of them. You know.
And I was reading over the screenplay and I noticed this opening note that you put in there that I'm going to read a little bit of it just so the listeners can hear. It said, based on this script's page count, it would be reasonable to assume that the total running time for Tarr would be well under 2 hours. However, this will not be a reasonable film. And then you go on to say, all this is to say, if you are mad enough to greenlight this film, be prepared for one whose necessary length represents these practical accommodations. So I'm curious, when you were writing the screenplay, you know, it sounds like you really led with that you needed to have the freedom to make the story you wanted to tell. Was that ever met with any resistance?
No, strangely, no. And I didn't receive one script note. I can't imagine ever having anyone, and as that note says, if you're mad enough to greenlight this film, I'm still sort of scratching my head that Peter Kujawski and Kieske Higgs were mad enough to greenlight this film, and ultimately Donna Langley and Jimmy Horowitz at Universal, because who on earth would ever greenlight this film?
I mean, from what I understand, Peter sort of gave you the freedom to tell what story you wanted to tell.
He did. I didn't tell them what I was setting out to do. I didn't tell them who the character was. I didn't tell them I think they probably assumed I was writing a story for a man. I didn't tell them anything. And I called them about halfway through writing it, because I realized that I probably should give them some kind of caution. And I said, look, I really don't want anyone to be out on a limb for this. I can't tell you what I'm doing, but I'm very excited about it. But when I hand it in, there's a 99.9% chance that you're going to hate it and not want to make it. And I'm just telling you this so there's no, to manage expectations, so there's no unhappiness, that if that is in fact the case, I'll be happy to work it off on some other script for you. But I have to write this, the thing I'm working on, I have to write it. And Peter said, well, appreciate, you know, you reaching out, but the truth is we just want to make a film with you. We don't care what you write, just write your film. And he that wasn't hyperbole. He consistently supported the film and stood by that statement. But it was a very generous thing for him to do, and there was a certain amount of risk obviously involved for him. And to have that kind of respect paid to you, you really want to meet that, you know. So he set the bar very high, and I tried to meet it as best I could.
And because you'd had other projects throughout the years that you'd been working on that, you know, didn't come to fruition, I'm curious, did you doubt that this would ever happen, even as you were writing it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've been directing for the last 16 years, but I do advertising, so I'm used to working a lot, you know, like directing is sort of second nature to me, but writing material and having it be rejected for either budgetary reasons or other allergies is something I'm fairly used to. So the idea that someone actually would, you know, green light a script, especially in this magnificent manner, is shocking. I'm still scratching my head.
And I know you wrote this script for Kate Blanchett, who stars in it. And I'm curious, did it at all require sort of a chase to get her to agree to it? Or would you have even ever made it if she'd passed?
No, I wouldn't have made it if she passed. And one thing, you know, I tried to be, again, respectful and transparent with the studio. But the one thing that I lied about when I handed it in was immediately Kieske Higgs and Peter Kujawski said, you must have someone in mind for this role. And I said, no, I have no idea. I'm just no idea what, because I was terrified that somebody might make a call or whatever and spook her, you know. So I kind of didn't do anything for about a month, and then Serena Rathbun, my wife, kind of kicked me under the table, you know, and said, "You need to quit being so sheepish. You need to call her. You need to find out whether you're doing this or not." And I did, and she said yes immediately. Now, part of that was surprising, because I think it's a very dangerous character, and I don't think that it wasn't a sure thing. You know, there was all kinds of reasons why she may have said no, but that speaks to who she is as an artist, that she said yes.
Right. And you obviously expected she would be able to deliver on what is quite a demanding performance, but how would you say she surprised even you once you were actually shooting the film?
Well, you know, like I said, she said yes immediately, and we were going to go straight into prep and then shoot the film. But there was a second lockdown that came up in Berlin at the time, and the film was designed so that I always wanted to have flat November light. That's sort of how I think about Berlin, you know, with no leaves on the trees, which meant that we would have to always start in September with the interiors, and then work our way outside and point towards windows and stuff at the appropriate seasonal corridor. And when that lockdown happened, we were going to have to push 12 months. There was no getting around it. And in that 12 months, I saw how much work Kate put in while she was making two other films. But there's knowing that, and there's being in dialogue with a collaborator, and it's quite another thing to be on the floor with someone for the first time. And that took my breath away.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
And I'm curious for you, do you feel, you know, as you mentioned, you've been working in film still, but not technically feature filmmaking. And I'm curious if those years away from making a feature like this, do you feel like they were necessary? Do you feel like they somehow allowed you to make this film?
Well, they allowed me to survive. They allowed me to raise a child. But they also made me a much stronger technical filmmaker. I worked with the finest film technicians and artists that are on the planet for 15 years, you know, and I shot all over the world. So I think there was a particular kind of muscle that was developed in doing advertising that I didn't have before. So technically, it was really exciting. I felt much more fearless about what I was doing. But the one difference is that when you're working in advertising, often you're dealing with cars or you're dealing with people that are not actors. And the very first day that we shot in Dresden at the Philharmonie, the very first scenes that we did were the scenes up in the rake after the rehearsal with Nina Haas and, and Cate Blanchett and Noémie Merlant. And having three actors of that caliber suddenly play a scene, that's when your heart just soars and you say, oh, I remember what this was like. You know, it's been a long time. And that was like a wall that hit me, like a wave that came over me I didn't really expect, you know, and that was a very, very heady place to be for the next several months.
Yeah, I can imagine. And how much did you think about navigating tone while you were making this? Because I've seen it with an audience a couple times, and sometimes there will be laughter at parts. You know, some of this dialogue is just so incredible, and it really elicits different responses from people in the audience. So how much were you thinking about navigating that?
I mean, tone is a funny thing, you know. I think ultimately it's just interpretation. So it really comes from your belly and not your head, you know. Unless you're doing flat out sight gags or something like that, and that's a very mechanical thing. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad to hear that. I've sat in a few audiences and there's been some titters at different places, and I say, okay, good. You know, somebody understood this. But the idea was to try not to point it at things. You know, if there's humor, not to really try to point at the humor. If the camera's going to do something, unless there's a damn good reason, not point at it. You know, it was really trying to stay out of the way so that there was room for the audience to come in and find things for themselves, you know, depending on who they are, where they just came from, you know, all the things that change your experience when you're, you know, viewing something collectively. But yeah, I remember being at the American Film Institute and they kept saying, you have to develop a style. Style's really important. You know, you need to be a stylist. And I thought, that's the last thing I would ever want to be, you know?
Right. Yeah. You bring up film school, and I was curious about the scene set at Juilliard, because I feel like a lot of people have been talking about that. And I'm wondering where the inspiration for that came from, if it was, little dabbles from your own experience at school or just straight from your head?
Well, it's funny. You've never, you're the first person that's ever drawn that line. And I suppose that's true. Yeah, we had a class at the American Film Institute called Narrative Analysis. It was a fairly brutal class. It was run by Dezsu Meghyar, who's a Hungarian filmmaker. And in that class, we made these things called cycle projects. And those cycle projects were under very particular circumstances. You had to shoot them for 4 days. You had a few hundred dollars and you had to edit them in 4 days. And then you had to view them in front of your peers in a classroom such as that and sit on stage while everybody threw tomatoes at you. And you were not allowed to talk back. And it was a utterly brutal situation, and it would be terrible to have the fruit thrown at you. It would be even worse if it was praise, because then you had a target on your back for the rest of the year. But it certainly there's certainly parallels to that scene. But really, the impetus for writing it, I think, was just the age old question. You know, what would your older self tell to your younger self? And this version of these two individuals, one is, you know, 50 years old, the other one is half that age. And the younger one is very much like Lydia Tarr was when she was 25 years old. She was breaking glass ceilings. She was ignoring the canon. She didn't care about, you know, dead white man music. She was going and getting her, you know, doctorate degree down, you know, doing ethnographic field work, you know, with very specific kinds of music with the Shipibo Kanibo people. So, yeah, but she couldn't be further from that, you know. Mm-hmm. She's also, you know, the scene sort of is triggered by her dismissing the choice of music from the student. that was important for me. So what is that music? Well, that music is very much like what she's describing later to her assistant that she's struggling with. She says it sounds like Charles Ives, like pastiche. Well, Charles Ives is the sort of, you know, parent of atonal music, very much so. And so she's trying to do something very similar to what she's criticizing. And the person that she's criticizing is female. She's younger. She's, as she would describe, quite beautiful. And she's also heralded as a very particular kind of a modern composer. So I think that's important. You know, why does she go after this student? Those are very personal reasons for her. She states them as being sort of large pieces of wisdom, but the truth is she has an agenda, you know?
Yeah. And one of my favorite things about this film is the theories that are being doled out on the internet about it. I was reading one today about the ending being all in her head and in a dream. And I'm sure, I'm curious how you take in that kind of engagement. Do you enjoy that people are coming up with their own theories about a lot of your storytelling?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why, the film is a dead thing unless people are doing that. You know, my intent is completely irrelevant. You know, the dream is that there's going to be enough room for anyone to come in and be the final filmmaker. I'd love to hear that. I'd love to hear when people attack the film for their own reasons. That interests me too. You know, I mean, yeah, there's no wrong way to read the film, and the film is meant to inspire as ferocious a or as superfluous as, you know, speculation as possible or opinions as possible, because that is the only intent behind it. You know, I very much like this Isaac Dennison quote. I think it's, you know, truth is for tailors and shoemakers. I've always found that the Lord has a penchant for masquerades, you know, mm-hmm. And we are dealing with fiction. You know, this is not a documentary.
Yeah. Have you seen any theories that sort of tickle you or that you found surprising?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to share any of them?
No.
Yeah, I think it's smart the way you allow everyone to have their own interpretation. The more you say, the less that happens, I think.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with anyone's interpretation or offer any other. It's great. Everybody, you know, this film has really very little to do with me anymore. Yeah.
So you're not going to tell me how Lydia Tarr got her EGOT, is what you're saying?
Oh, man. So many people really, really want... I have a little box with all of the answers to that, but that box is sealed.
Maybe in like 10 years.
Yeah, maybe in 10 years. Yeah.
And I'm curious, was there any other film or piece of art or book that sort of really inspired or influenced you as you were writing this?
Well, many things, for sure. I mean, there's a very, you know, she name drops Antonio Brico in the first interview with Adam Gopnik. And there's a very good documentary. Have you ever seen it from the 1970s about Antonio Brico?
No, I haven't seen it.
I highly recommend it. I think it won the Academy Award for Best Doc. I don't remember which year it was, but that was a giant inspiration, for sure. You know,
what was it about that documentary?
Well, she, by all accounts, she was an incredible conductor, mm-hmm. and she conducted as a guest conductor for the Berlin Philharmonic and the Metropolitan, and she became so wildly popular because it was such a novel thing to have a female conductor, that I believe, and I may have this wrong, but I believe she was sort of given a principal conductor post for an all-female orchestra that would perform at Carnegie Hall. And I think one of those patrons was Eleanor Roosevelt. So there was a whole society of sort of supporters of very wealthy people and their wives, sort of uptown people that backed her. But there was a certain point where she said, this is silly, you know, I don't think of myself as a female conductor, and I don't need to have female players. I just want the best players. And she wanted to to balance the orchestra, you know, in terms of that being a criteria as opposed to single gender. And of course, once the novelty of it being all women, once that went out the window, and there's a little touching of that in the scene between Lydia Tarr and her, you know, her patron, this sort of amateur conductor come, you know, financial guru, Elliot Kaplan, played by Mark Strong, when she says she wants to bust up her fellowship as being single gender, you know. That's sort of what happened to Antonio Brico. And then she lost her post, you know, and she wasn't able to conduct for most of the rest of her life. And she's very stoic in the documentary, but at the end of it, there's one moment where she kind of lets her guard down a bit. And they say, what's it been like not to conduct all this time? And that kind of resonated with me, maybe because I haven't made a film in so long, you know, because her answer was, I'm a musician, but I don't have a piano and I don't have a horn and I don't have a drum and I don't have a you know, string instrument. I have human beings, and without them, I'm silenced. And it's the only time where you just feel you could see the pain in her face. You know, she needed other people to be a musician.
Yeah, well, I definitely will have to check out this documentary, and I assume lots of our listeners will after hearing about it. And we're almost out of time, but I am curious, you know, you mentioned how Lydia Tarr was, this character was with you for so long, and now that the film is out and you're done essentially with this, are you able to sort of move on from that once you've been able to tell the story like this, or does it kind of stick with you after?
Well, I never go back and look at films that I've been involved with. But I think this will be a very hard thing to get off of me, just because it came right out of the pandemic and it happened very quickly. So I really haven't had a break since I finished the film. You know, we finished the film right before Venice. So I'm looking forward to going home at some point out into the pasture and, you know, stripping off my clothes that I made this film in and making a bonfire. Hopefully that will help. It's hard to let films go. It's a real nuisance, especially when you talk about them so much, you know.
That does it for today's episode. We'll be back later this week with our regular roundtable conversation. You can find us on Twitter in the meantime at HWD. You can email us, please, with your questions for our mailbag episode coming up before the holidays at littlegoldmen@vf.com. Or you can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, and Rebecca?
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.